Mario Vargas Llosa is one of the writers associated with the boom, that is, the boom in Latin American fiction that began in the 1960s. Vargas Llosa is Peruvian, and his novels draw on his knowledge of the politics, culture, and history of his country. Writer and critic John Updike called Vargas Llosa's writing a model of the most that political fiction can be. Robert Stone praised Vargas Llosa for his confident and intellectually exciting handling of the big questions. Vargas Llosa's career got started with a bang. His first novel, The Time of the Hero, was set in a military academy. After its publication in 1963, the Peruvian military burned 1,000 copies of it. Vargas Llosa was in Europe at the time, where he lived from 1958 until 1974, when he returned to Peru. His novels include Conversations in the Cathedral, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, and The Year of the End of the World. I asked him first about his latest novel, Who Killed Palomino Molero, which has just been published in paperback. It's a murder mystery, and I wanted to know if he meant it as an homage to detective fiction.
Well, not exactly, because I'm not a great amateur of detective novels, you know. What I tried to do in this novel was to use the form of a thriller to tell a story which I think is not a detective novel, but something different. My intention in Who Killed Palomino Molero was not to tell a story about the investigation of a crime, but to use the investigation of a crime as a means to describe the mechanisms of power, or better, the mechanism of corruption of power in a country like Peru in the early 50s.
So your novels aren't so much concerned with who committed the violence, but why do people commit violence?
Exactly, or even better, why the violences that are committed are very difficult to be punished.
What kind of violence have you been exposed to, politically or socially, that has led to this interest?
Well, I think the kind of violence that appears in the novel is the kind of violence that you find more or less in all Latin American countries, a violence that derives from economic underdevelopment, from political corruption, from dictatorships, and also from social and economic inequalities in society. On the other hand, I tried in this novel to use the detective form, the detective devices, not only as a pretext, but also as something that could interest and thrill the curiosity of the reader. And in this sense, it was a new experience for me as a writer, because it was the first time that I used this technique in one of my novels.
You're one of the writers associated with what's been called the boom of the 1960s, the boom in Latin American fiction and its concurrent popularity in America. Do you... it's ironic in a way that you were living in Europe at the time in the 1960s when your novel started to catch on.
Yes, I was, but and this was not only my case. You know, I think many Latin American writers, as myself, became Latin Americans when they were living abroad. I think they discovered, as it was my case, that Latin America was something more important than national cultures or national identities, and that we shared a lot from a cultural, historical, and a social point of view among the Latin American countries. And I think this process, which I personally had living in Europe in the 60s, was also the case of other Latin American writers.
What was it about living in Paris in the 1960s that brought out your identification with Latin America?
Well, first, I discovered that I was not an European and that I would never be an European.
I mean, you felt you had trouble fitting in with this culture that you had identified with.
Well, look, when I went to Europe in 1958, what I read mostly was European writers or North American writers, and I was really not much informed nor interested in what Latin America produced. And it was only living in Europe, meeting there writers and people from Venezuela, from Argentina, from Mexico. Paris at that time was really a central point of Latin American people, that I little by little became interested in Latin America and start to think of myself more as a Latin American than as a Peruvian. And I think this is something that happened also to writers like the Argentine Julio Cortázar, who was living in Paris since the beginning of the 50s, and probably many, many other writers started to feel as Latin Americans more than Venezuelans, Argentines, or Mexicans when they went abroad and perceived Latin America as a whole, something that it was not so common in the 50s when you were living in a Latin American country.
So part of many of the novels you've written about your country have been written from abroad. Did you try to keep coming back to Peru so that you'd understand how the country was changing over the years and so you'd be able to still be current in your perceptions?
Well, I lived in Europe since 58 until 74. But during those years, I returned many times to Peru for short periods of time, 1 month and, well, even 2 months once. But only in 74, I returned to live in Peru. And I decided to come back to my country because, yes, I had the feeling that I was losing touch, losing contact with what was going on, with all the changes in Peru, and even with the language, with the Spanish Peruvian language, and that I felt as a threat for my writing, for my vocation. So I decided to return, and since 1974 I've been living in Peru.
So you mean you needed to speak the language in order to keep writing in it?
Well, to speak, to hear the language. I think it's very important to hear the language, is the living language. I think that is very important for a writer, or at least for the kind of writer that I am, a writer that is always working with the living experience of his world, of his society. For that, I think it was very important to keep in touch with what was going on in my country.
Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest, and his new novel is titled Who Killed Palomino Molero? You've become politically outspoken in Peru, and one of the things you've been speaking out against is President Alan Garcia's plan to nationalize banking. Why are you taking such an active stand on that?
Well, because I want to preserve democracy in Peru. I think it's very important to keep this democratic system that we have in Peru since 1980, when the military dictatorship was obliged to call elections. Many Peruvians felt that it was a threat to democracy, this nationalization of the whole financial system, which would have given to the government and a tremendous power to manipulate the media and to manipulate elections. If we want to keep a democratic system, we don't want a one-party democracy, and that's what would have been happening in Peru if the government of Alan Garcia would have control of the whole economy of the country through the credits.
You've described yourself in the past as a political moderate, and I think some of the other best-known Latin American writers like Marquez and Fuentes are probably more politically to the left than you are. Has that created some distance between you and them?
Well, not personal. Political distance, yes, because I don't think extremism can solve the problems of Latin America. My impression is that most of the problems that we have derive from the extremist policies. And I think moderation is the best way to stop the violence that is being so damaging and, in some cases, threats to destroy our societies. But if you believe in democracy, you accept discrepancies, that you must be tolerant with people who think differently of you.
You've said that you think that many Latin American intellectuals are too dogmatic.
Well, because in Latin America, you know, something curious arrives, something curious happens, and that is that extremist ideologies, dogmaticism, and even fanatical attitudes are more common in the university and intellectual circles than in the workers or peasants sections of the population.
The middle class, in other words.
Yes. That means that the victims, the worst victims of societies, of our social and economic inequalities, are for moderation. And in fact, people who in a way can be considered privileged or beneficiaries of the system are sometimes in favor of radicalism and even the most extremist policies. And it's a very curious contradiction.
My guest is writer Mario Vargas Llosa, and his latest novel is titled Who Killed Palomino Mulero? I want to go back to 1963 and to your first novel that really got you recognition, The Time of the Hero. This was a satire of life in a Peruvian military academy. Now, this was based in part on your experiences in a military academy, yes?
Yes, that's right. I was for 2 years in the military school, which is the settlement of the Time of the Hero.
Did you want to go?
No, I didn't. It was really my father who suggested the military school, and at that time I had the thought for once to go to the Navy school when I finished my school, and that was the reason why I accepted the suggestion of my father. It was a very difficult experience. I had, in fact, a shock when I was submitted to this discipline, military discipline in the school, a discipline which was, in many cases, well, brutal, really barbaric, and that gave me the idea of the novel. Yes, that was my first novel, and I wrote it between 1958 and 1961.
Now, you had wanted to be a writer even when you were younger, and I think that your father considered that a little effeminate. Did he want to send you to the military academy to toughen you up a little bit? Was that the idea?
Well, my father, as many middle-class people in Latin America in the 50s, you know, thought that to be a writer was to be an eccentric, someone marginal to the extreme life of society. Literature or art in general at that time in Latin America was really an eccentric activity, and so he was worried when he discovered that I wrote poems or short stories, and he thought that maybe a military school could be an antidote for this literary vocation.
Kind of backfired, didn't it?
In fact, it backfired, and it was the opposite, yes.
So you were exposed to very harsh discipline. Are there incidents that you really remember still with a lot of anger or horror when you look back?
Well, no, because all the bad experiences I have turned it into literature, you know, and so I've been cured of those bad experiences through my books.
Now, the military burned, I think, 1,000 copies of that novel about the military academy. Was it the people who were at the school that you wrote about?
Well, the copies were burned at the school as a protest against what they thought it was an insult against the school and against the tradition of the school. But I wasn't in Peru at that time, you know. I was living in Europe, so I only read in the papers about this this event, I was really surprised because I had thought that my book would be well published and that there would be some readers from the book in Peru, but I never expected such an scandal. And all this, of course, was great publicity for the book. So the book became a kind of bestseller in Peru. But I never knew if it was because its literary qualities or because the military had burned 1,000 copies of it.
Did you get a kick out of reading articles about the burning of your book while you were living in Europe?
Well, I was so amazed, you know, when I received this clippings of the papers with the this inquisitorial action, you know. I couldn't believe my eyes. I was really, really amazed, you know.
Did you want to know the details, like where was it burned? Did they use gasoline to set it on fire? You know, that kind of stuff.
No, well, that what I knew was that the burn had taken place at the school and in an official ceremony, but there was a big scandal. There were many generals, for instance, who went to the papers, to the media, to denounce the book as something offensive for the army. And there was even that was probably the most unexpected and comic reaction to the book. A general who was at that time, I think, the chairman of a center for military studies, wrote an article in a newspaper saying that probably this book had been paid by the Ecuadorian army in order to demoralize the Peruvian soldiers and officers. And that was probably the most comic reaction that this book produced in Peru. Huh?
Well, young writers need confidence. This must have given you a shot of confidence to have such a strong reaction.
Well, yes. In fact, it gave me a lot of enthusiasm because I discovered that my novel had reached, you know, an audience and also had provoked this kind of passional reactions that literature, I think, should provoke.
Huh? Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Writer Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest, and his latest novel is titled Who Killed Palomino Molyero? This is Fresh Air. Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest. Well, you were telling us that your father had really been afraid that writing was a much too marginal kind of profession, and from what I've read, he thought it was a little effeminate, too. Did that kind of fear of writing and the arts stay with you at all? Did you get totally purged of thinking, well, what your father thought about it or what other adults or people in the mainstream might have thought about it?
Well, there were many prejudices in Peru and I presume in other Latin American countries against writers and artists. In the 50s, I think that this has changed a lot in Latin America, particularly since this phenomenon called the boom of the Latin American narrative. Since then, on the contrary, I would say that literature has become fashionable in Latin America, and that there are. On the contrary, now a favorable prejudice for writers. In this, we have experienced really great changes in Latin America. When I started as a writer, you know, a Latin American writer well had tremendous difficulties to be published, and most writers publish their books themselves. And they knew that only very few copies would be sold, and that the possibility of their books to reach really a large audience was very, very rare, very exceptional. This has changed since the 60s a lot. Now there are many publishing houses. It's difficult that a good novel it's difficult that a good novel wouldn't be published. On the contrary, there are publishers trying to find books, and we have books that that sell in Latin America sometimes by hundreds of thousands of copies, something that was unthinkable 30 years ago.
I want to ask you about another one of your novels, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, which is also pretty autobiographical, and it's about a young writer who's working in the news department of a radio station trying to break into writing. And there's a Bolivian writer who writes the soap operas for this radio station in Peru, and the soap operas, everybody just like stops during the day to listen to them. Did you have experiences like that? Were you working at a news department at a radio station when you were starting out? And did you know a very successful but kind of crazy soap opera writer?
Well, soap operas were tremendously popular all over Latin America in the 50s when I worked in that radio station. And there was in a neighboring radio station a soap opera scriptwriter who was very popular in Peru. And he was, an inspiration for the character of the soap opera scriptwriter of Aunt Julia and the scriptwriter. But this is not a biography of that scriptwriter. I've used this just as a raw material, and there are much more invention than history in the book. And even in the autobiographical chapters in the book, in which the author appears himself as a character, there is a lot also of deformation and manipulation of the truth. No? So it's a novel, not it's a disguise autobiography.
Well, I think it's the character appearing as the novelist who says that at the time he was obsessed with the idea that fiction should be realistic. Did you go through a period like that yourself?
Well, I think I still have this realistic, how can I say, orientation, perversion, I don't know. But I need to have the feeling that my books have a hold, are sustained in a realistic experience, even if I am perfectly conscious that literature is never a mere reflection of reality, a mere reproduction of reality. I think literature is a separate reality, something that you creates and something that has a distance with reality. But for me, the way in which I imagine, I fantasize, I invent more easily is having the real world, the real life as a model for my writing.
Now, one other question about Aunt Julia and the scriptwriter. One of the many places I think that your life overlaps the life of the main character is that the main character marries his older divorced aunt and then marries a cousin, and that is also what happened in your life. Was that something of a scandal in your family?
Well, yes, it was. Yes, it was. I married when I was very young. I was 18 years old, and this, of course, for my family was a great surprise and a great great scandal at the beginning. Yes. But I've been surrounded by scandals all my life. You
know? Was it coincidence that you married two women who were parts of the family in some way?
Well, I don't know. Let's ask a psychoanalyst, you know?
Okay. You have an essay that you wrote several years ago called Is Fiction the Art of Lying? And now I think it was, maybe it wasn't in that essay, maybe it was in another essay, that you were writing about something that James Baldwin once wrote, and how it resonated with you. And Baldwin said that when he was at one of these big writers' conferences, he'd always want to be able to tell, is this audience racist or not? And the way he would do it would be to spout absurd theories and stupid remarks, and if these stupid remarks evoked a big ovation from the audience, he'd know that they were really racist.
Yes.
How does that apply to your
experiences? No, it wasn't in that article, but it was in another article. But yes, I always have in mind this anecdote that I heard James Baldwin to tell. Yes. Well, I think it's very, very instructive what he said about prejudices, about... I used this anecdote to write an article describing a literary meeting in Denmark in which Danish writers had invited a radical Latin American writer who, during the whole Congress, pronounced the most crazy and stupid demagogic speeches, you know. But all the Danish writers that were there felt obliged to listen very attentively, to show great sympathy and enthusiasm for all the stupid things that they were hearing. And I suppose the reason was exactly, as in the James Baldwin anecdote, because this writer came from Latin America, represented for them the voice of the exploited people, and so they felt that they were obliged to give respect and admiration to something that in the mouth of a Danish writer would have been absolutely unacceptable for them, you know.
So are there times that you've tried this out yourself to test if an audience is reacting in a biased way to your remarks?
No, I have never done that.
Now, you write in Spanish, yes?
Yes, I do.
Do you ever read the translations of your work?
Well, I try to help the translators if they want to, if they ask me to, well, to suggest or to give them some advice. Yes, of course, I do it. But in general, I don't like to go back to what I've written, you know.
So when you read the translations, do you like them usually?
No, usually not.
You're retranslating it in your own mind?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. His latest novel, Who Killed Palomino Molero, has just been published in paperback by Collier Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.